Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. Now, the big story this week is, of course, the confirmation of our contention, our thesis here, that we are looking at a prolonged strategy of tension administered in ways favorable to the fascist demagogue Trump, and that that terrorism will now be the constant, if you will, the invariant of the time between now and the November 8th election, unless some of these networks are rolled up, unless somebody decides to put a mole detector at the FBI, CIA, NSA, and the rest of them. It's going to be a hot summer, a long hot summer, and then it's going to be a hot autumn. And it's going to be a strategy of tension, and it's likely to be crowned by some kind of crescendo, one event or multiple events, which will be definable as an October, perhaps an August to September to October surprise. But it's already the end of June, so August is only, what, 5-6 weeks away. So we are in the thick of things. And don't just listen to me. We are told by the beneficiary himself, the guy who stands to get the most positive returns on this. Trump has said in his tweet on June 12th, he says, Orlando is just the beginning. Trump, how do you know that? Why isn't Trump arrested and forced to testify? Can't you indict him for some kind of material support? He says, Orlando is just the beginning. And then he says also in another tweet, he says, it will get worse. He seems to know an awful lot about terrorism. One who, supposedly is, of course, a moron. But in that rag bag of a mind, he seems to have the idea that terrorism is coming, and he's gloating. He's gloating. He's happy about this, of course, because it's helping him. Remember, we have the Roman writer, right? This is Roman Empire, early Roman Empire. Lucius Aeneas Seneca, right? Seneca was the tutor, the teacher for the Emperor Nero. And of course, once Nero came into power, he went around killing all the people as he thought, wronged him in the course of his upbringing, and his own mother. But he also killed his principal teacher, Seneca. So, an example, if you will, of megalomania, right? So Nero was somebody who he couldn't imagine that somebody would correct him or tell him that he was not the greatest singer or the greatest emperor or the greatest politician. So he made sure that Seneca was forced to commit suicide. So that's not the part we need. The Seneca had written a play, Medea, and in there we have these famous lines, cui prodest scelus is facit, okay? The one who benefits from the crime is the one who committed it. And perhaps we could say, well, he's the prime suspect. Another way to put this is cui bono, who gets the good out of this, or cui prodest, again, who, the shorter version of the first one, who is the one who derives benefit from it? Well, of course, that's Trump. Now, we have to feel free to say this because Trump has opened up this whole issue of what politician benefits from terrorism. It's Trump. Trump is the one. One of the articles today, I think, on Real Clear Politics, if I'm not missing my guess again, there's a little paragraph that says, you know, when bad things happen, the incumbent president is generally blamed. This is more or less a structural feature of this more or less democratic representative government that we have. So bad things happen, incumbent or incumbent's allies or incumbent's anointed successor get blamed. So that means, as I've tried to argue now for quite a few weeks, there's a structural tendency for bad thing, right? It could be a financial panic. It could be a wave of terrorism beyond anything we've seen before. It could be military events, military defeats. Obama will be blamed, and therefore Hillary will be blamed, and Trump will come out of it smelling like a rose, except he won't, because it's clear that these events have been designed, and I'll show you this in detail, a detailed analysis of the Orlando. It's with Trump, it's something that's helping him. Although, if we go back to Benghazi in 2012, September 11, 2012, we will find that if you have a politician of great stupidity and great ineptitude with a tin ear and no mass instincts like Romney, you'll also see same thing with Trump. In other words, he has no idea of how to play an event like this, right? The article that I'm thinking of says, if you are the challenger and terrorism occurs, then you got to realize that's going to be automatically blamed on the incumbent and the incumbent's political allies and successors. So therefore, what you have to do is simply make a very low-key statement of sympathy to the victim, right? My thoughts and prayers are with blah, blah, blah. And then watch public opinion do its work and take down, at least to some extent, your opponent. But Trump can't do that. He steps on his own line every time, right? State Department report attacks Hillary. Trump goes out and changes the subject by attacking the Mexican judge. He's from Mexico, Indiana. So Trump goes out and does that. He steps on all of his own lines. He interferes with his own propaganda messaging. He's inept. He's a moron. He's a megalomaniac. He's not going according to some strategy which would be planned out. He's simply responding to that raging sense of inferiority and abandonment which is within him, that his father was absent. His mother may well have also been absent, but above all, the father was clearly absent. He is a narcissist. He is a megalomaniac. And by now is becoming a cliche among all kinds of commentators that when they say that Trump is a narcissist, that's not their main thesis, but they say this in passing, which means that they think this part has been explained and that they will be understood on that with Trump. So Trump has said that somehow Obama is responsible for this specific attack. Now, let's distinguish here. If you want to say that Obama, in a general, takes responsibility for the things that have happened in U.S. foreign policy since 2009, well, there's obviously a justification for that. So Trump says that Obama is somebody who refuses to say the magic words. We'll talk about magic, too, in a minute. He refuses to say radical Islamic terrorism. And we also have Trump suggesting that Obama is in league with the terrorists, that he sympathizes with the terrorists, therefore he probably is a terrorist, is what Trump has to say. But at that point, that has to be rebutted, right? That's fair comment. And it's clear that the beneficiary of terrorism is not Obama at all. It's Trump. So put your pipe smoke at Trump. Back in a minute. Now keep up with all of this, of course, at Tarpley.net. Tarpley.net and the daily briefing that we put out, this was one of our great weeks, I would say. And it was the idea that we had to respond to this false flag event, right? This orchestrated terror event, which was obviously orchestrated by intelligence community factions favorable to Trump. We don't say Trump like, you know, Trump vis-a-vis Obama. No, no, no. We say intelligence community factions favorable to a Trump seizure of power, a Trump presidency. But of course, it wouldn't just be a presidency. It would be a seizure of power, eine Machtergreifung, power seizure, as it was said in late January 1933. So, Trump, we don't have to quote these idiotic fragments of thought, where he essentially he suggests that there's something wrong with Obama, and therefore we don't, you know, you can't trust Obama. All these things that he says, right? But he has essentially broadly suggested that Obama is in league with the terrorists. Well, I would regard the events of this past week as showing that, quite to the contrary, we have a scenario which is now active, which actually goes back to the Nixon years. It's very interesting with Trump. There are two sides to Trump, more or less. There's the Richard Nixon side, and this seems to be when Trump sort of came into some kind of conscious political participation. But Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, of what published sources have called Manafort, especially the Torturers Lobby, a public relations firm in Washington here, which represented many oppressive, brutal governments around the world, people that did carry out torture. So that's sort of the Nixon side. And you can see that with Trump. But in this case particularly, the strategy of tension, the first one, right? NATO has done this quite a few times, but the first one, and in many ways one of the main ones, was Italy in the second half of 1969, the so-called hot autumn, a period of intense labor activism, strike wave in the fall of 1969, and a time of gains for the Italian Communist Party. And of course, they were very weak ideologically and in terms of their leadership. So it wasn't clear what they would do. They never figured out what to do. But one of the ways they were kept off balance was through a series of the clashes in the public squares, and then above all, a bomb put into the National Agricultural Bank in Milan, near the university, near the center of town, which killed, as I recall, about a dozen people. And that was mid-December of 1969. So that side of it, right, this October surprise strategy of tension aspect, this goes back to that side of Nixon. And, of course, the other side is Senator Joe McCarthy, right, the witch hunt. And that comes from the fact that one of Trump's key mentors is the infamous Roy Cohn, the lawyer who was the right-hand man of Senator Joe McCarthy, the infamous thug and witch hunter who went around destroying people's lives. And that, I think, that's something that that remains with Trump. So we have all this. Now, what have we been saying, right? In particular, we have been warning about this since early May, actually since late April. And you'll recall that one of the one of the ways we know about this is that a number of well-known sort of mainstream media people have talked about this. And we take it back to April 2nd. So this is an article in the Daily Briefing. National revulsion against Trump reaching critical mass. GOP operatives eye terrorism on scale of Paris or Brussels as possible outside events to save the Republican ticket. We can talk in a while about how Trump standing in the polls seems to be eroding. He seems to be not quite in free fall. He's in a significant decline. And this headline goes on to read, September, October surprise plausible. Intelligence community factions supporting Trump are prime suspects in any terror attacks between now and November election. So that was April 2nd. So April, May, and more than half of June have gone by, at least 2.5 months since we put that out. And, of course, we cataloged the fact that Bill Maher had talked about it, one of the first. Frank Luntz, the Republican operative, had talked about it, something that could perhaps save the Trump candidacy. Thomas L. Friedman of the New York Times has talked about it twice that I know of, once on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. Charlie Rose has talked about it on his program, and the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC-FM New York has talked about it. And we should also add that just now in the wake of the event, I think this was on Sunday, we had Peter Bergen of the CNN. He's one of the CNN resident experts on terrorism, mentioned the term October surprise, which is perhaps a little bit more explicit than some of these others. So here's what we said about it, okay? In the wake of a large-scale terror attack, Trump would demand that all power be concentrated in his hands in a virtual state of siege, just like Hitler in late January 1933, because he had been the only one to correctly forecast an imminent terrorist bloodbath. Trump had seen that. That has happened since, of course, since this was written. Trump could expect backing from those same media factions, which have already given him more than $2 billion worth of free media for his primary campaign. The real estate demagogue might have a substantial chance of winning the Electoral College only on this basis, right? And then if he got into power, he would begin to abuse the USA Patriot Act, the Espionage Act, and he would come after people with NSA eavesdropping, right? As he said on a libertarian show, "We must have surveillance," said the fascist Trump. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley here in Washington, D.C. So, as people know, I think we have been warning about this question of a strategy of tension out of the Nixonian Kissinger foreign policy handbook. We know that Trump is meeting with Kissinger. A lot of Nixonian gravity going on here. And then, of course, the Roy Cohn, Senator Joe McCarthy, witch hunt, right? And you notice that some of, Trump's, supporters have now gotten into this thing about, trying to red bait their opponents. If somebody says, well, Trump is a fascist, then they say, oh, well, then you must be some kind of Bolshevik. And this, of course, is absolutely absurd. It simply shows the moral and intellectual bankruptcy of people that get pulled into this strudel, this maelstrom of Trumpism. All right. Now, I guess we probably ought to stay with this now since we've come this far. Let's look at how unsatisfactory the official explanation is. And we've got to remember, though, that Trump is now, to some degree, married to the official version of this. So we're going to take this down, right? We're going to show that Trump, of course, is an utterly unprincipled demagogue and that he's lying about all this stuff. Let's go to one of the couple of structural features. Or better yet, let's do something methodological. To begin with, as people may know, I am the author of a book about the 9/11 events, but of course it's more than that. It's about the entire pattern of terrorism, right? Of false flag terrorism, synthetic terrorism. And remember, the synthetic means two things. One, that it's artificial, right? Like synthetic rubber. It's not really rubber. In other words, it's not what you think under that term. It doesn't come out of a tree. And in this case, it's terrorism. You've got to see much more about where it actually comes from, because it's not the spontaneous sociological process that many would think. So this is one side. The other thing, synthetic, means that it's bringing together separate elements, right? Elements that are fetched in from quite a ways away. So disparate elements that are put together to create what is essentially an epistemological optical illusion, right? It's where these different planes of illusion intersect. But the components, well, the first one is you've got to be aware of the patsies. And, of course, in this case, we have a patsy. That is Omar Mateen. Omar Mateen is now the official patsy of this. And, of course, there is an attempt to accredit him as a lone assassin, a solitary, isolated killer, usually a troubled loner, like Lee Harvey Oswald, like Mohammed Atta. You get the idea. Then, of course, in addition to the patsies, we've got the people who helped this all to happen, and these are the moles. These are the people inside the bureaucracy. They are not, in this country, loyal to the president. They're not loyal to the Constitution. They are loyal to a private network of old boys, and that generally turns out to be a Wall Street network connected to some big banks and their intelligence operations. And these are not people that are creatures of government, really, right? The U.S. has a weak bureaucracy in that sense, right? The Prussian bureaucracy under Bismarck had a lot of people in it who really were in there for the Prussian bureaucracy. The U.S. has a somewhat weaker position in that regard. But the moles, anyway, these are moles, and they have their own network, right? The wise men, not the wise guys, but the wise men. So the Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles, Dean Acheson, all the rest of them, John J. McCloy. One of the things to do is to make sure that the patsies don't get arrested, because if the patsies are rounded up before the fact, then if the patsy is sitting in jail, you can't blame the patsy for the explosion or the crime or the murders, okay? So that's what goes on. This is why we told Obama, right? You can find this also in the daily briefing. There are two things you have to do, Obama. You've got to wipe out ISIS militarily. In other words, take care of them over there so that they are broken up and defeated and everybody can see this. And we have some positive things to report on that level. But the other question then is, you've got to put a mole detector at FBI headquarters, CIA Langley, NSA Fort Meade. You get the idea. A mole detector. Now, unfortunately, this is not so easy to do, but that's what you got to do. You've got to, when you get an event like this, we have just seen FBI Director Comey in an unbelievable complacency, something that just cries out to heaven with all these people dead and all those who have died. Comey says, I don't think our people did anything wrong. We're going to look into it, of course, but I think we did everything right. Well, you better resign at that point, Comey. I would say we need the resignation of Comey on the basis of ministerial responsibility. In other words, if something like this, the biggest massacre in American history using firearms, single small arms, let's say, small arms massacre, then Comey, that happened on your watch, it's automatic. You're out. That's all we can do. You've got to go. And that would have been the case for Ashcroft on 9/11. It would have been the case for Robert Mueller on 9/11 and similarly other tragic events. It's not personal. It's structural. Because otherwise you have the situation, and we've gone through this before. You had Ashcroft in the post 9/11 period. He's demanding more and more power every time he fails. So he basically has an incentive to fail more. Now, I don't think he needs it. He's got plenty of incentive coming from this rogue network, secret government, parallel government, and so forth, right? He's got all that already. He doesn't need more incentive. But if he lacked incentive, he could say, well, I just have to fail a few more times and I'll be the dictator because they'll give me all power. And we've known, right, many countries, if the soccer team loses, the national soccer team, the sports minister has to quit. If there's a railroad crash, the transportation minister has to quit. It's automatic. It's not even discussable. But not here. The oligarchy here is so strong. They say, well, once you're an oligarch, success or failure don't mean anything. And if Trump were really an enemy of elites, he would be calling for the ouster of Comey, which is a perfectly legitimate, normal, really routine thing. But of course, Comey is shameless. So we need Comey out. Now, why do we say this? The FBI had, as far as we know so far, 4 chances to figure out what Mateen was up to. And we're told that in 2013, Mateen, the accused patsy, right, the alleged, and I don't ever say he did anything, right, he's just the alleged, let's call him the alleged patsy, because we really know very little. Don't take any hearsay, right, it's all hypothetical. 2013, the FBI did 2 interviews on Mateen after he was overheard boasting of his ties to international Islamist terrorism. And that would have been his personal or family ties to Al-Qaeda. Then in 2014, it was another one. And then the most recently would have been the FBI could have gone after him and found him after he tried to buy body armor and large amounts of ammunition from the Lotus Gun Works in Jensen Beach, Florida, where the gun shop owner was Robert Abel. So that would have been the 4th chance they could have found him. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to the here in Washington, D.C. So, the FBI. The FBI has failed again. We had, in the case of the Boston Marathon bombing, the Tsarnaev brothers, we had, in that case, the Russian Federation sending, I believe, 1 warning to the FBI, 1 warning to the CIA, that the Tsarnaev brothers were dangerous terrorists, and these were, of course, ignored. And in this other case now, we've had 3 FBI interviews, plus a case where even the gun shop owner could figure out that terrorism was on the agenda. And don't tell me that the FBI can't find you based on a surveillance tape and based on a analysis of neighborhoods and stuff like that. Right? They could simply say, round up all the usual suspects and see what we find, or go and barge in on them and visit them. Okay? This was Robert Abel of the Lotus Gun Shop, Gunworks, and he says that he had Mateen Omar in the store saying that he wanted to buy heavy-duty, exceptionally resilient body armor and mass quantities of ammunition. During the course of his presence in the gun shop, he talked on the phone to a third party in a language other than English. Okay. We've also got that during the course of the event in the Pulse nightclub, that the accused patsy was talking on the telephone with other people, sometimes in English, sometimes in a foreign language. All right, so this is already terrible. What was it the governor said, the chairman of the 9/11 commission? It was that the FBI failed and failed and failed and failed and failed and failed and failed. I don't know how many fails he has in there, but he had about 6 fails, and that's an underestimate. So the FBI, of course, useless, right? All that money for the FBI, and no result, right? And it's again and again and again, right? From the Atlanta to the crime lab to Wenho Lee. In other words, it goes back, you know, easily 20 years. It really goes back to J. Edgar Hoover, right, whose business was blackmail and not law enforcement and certainly not anti-terrorism. So then we have this other problem. How many shooters? We know from the time of the 2 to 3 Oswalds, we know that if the patsies that are supposed to be one lone assassin, if you've got persistent reports that there's more than one shooter, then you're dealing with something different. It becomes, horror of horrors, a conspiracy. It does, according to any U.S. attorney. They'll tell you that. So it's a it can actually be a conspiracy of one person. So two shooters. Who says this? We have two eyewitnesses, and you can find them at Tarpley.net. Daniel Gonzalez and Lediana Puyanera. G-O-N-Z-A-L-E-Z and P-U-Y-A-N-E-R-A. Daniel Gonzalez, Lediana Puyanera. And what they say is there were two shooters. Lediana says, no way, it could have been anything fewer. And Daniel Gonzalez is more or less the same thing, that there were two shooters and they were working together. Now, as the Lediana Puyanera story comes thanks to Erin Burnett out front on CNN and her reporter, Nick Valencia, who deserves commendation. Well, he pointed to the fact that the FBI and the local police are adamant that this is impossible, that there's only one shooter and he's dead and that's the end of it. Do you remember those interesting scenes in the Oliver Stone JFK movie when some people who knew that there had been shooting from the grassy knoll or wherever it was, that they were leaned on, right? They were told, they were shown photographs and said, look, I'm instructing you that you saw something different from what you actually have seen. This is unbelievable. We've also had a drill. A mass casualty drill was held at a local hospital something less than a year before this. So that goes into the mix. So what we're left with is two shooters at least. You got one patsy, one other shooter. Now, the shooters who disappear often go into the category of the technicians, and with that, the apology is complete. The patsy is the Oswald who gets caught. The mole is the anonymous bureaucrat who makes sure that nobody rounds up the patsy or otherwise cramps his style. And the technicians are the ones, as trained professionals, who actually make the terror event happen. They are the protagonists behind the scenes. And they're not supposed to get caught either. The technicians, least of all, the moles can sometimes be accused. Remember David Frasca and that group in the FBI who simply wouldn't take it seriously when they were getting these things from Minneapolis office, as I recall, right? They were just absolutely ruling it out. Now, the patsy himself, Mateen, he's an employee of G4S, right? The ex-Wackenhut security company of Great Britain. Great Britain is already a red flag, right? U.S. terrorism and Great Britain, from Emma Goldman to Edwin Booth, John Wilkes Booth. John Wilkes Booth, I guess, is the one. There's especially when it gets to presidential assassinations, just about all of them have some British element because of this British métier of destabilizing the United States, right? That this was a former colony and they want it back. They still want it back. There's no doubt. So all of that is going on. So there's a guy who's basically a cop. He could be halfway a cop, or he could be a total cop. It's a company, this Wackenhut or G4S, if I've got that right. They contract with all kinds of U.S. government agencies, and therefore, well, the guy's, you know, he's already under surveillance. Every time he goes to his office, he's going to be seeing people who can report on him. I think, again, he's the idea that this guy is actually a security guard with a permit to carry a gun, to shoot a gun, and things like this. This seems to have gotten lost in the soap opera stuff. And then Wackenhut is the previous name for this. This was a security company, spook-ridden and scandal-ridden. So that's what we have there. Now, by the way, I should have mentioned a prestigious name here, not in my book, but in somebody else's. In terms of the two shooters, we have Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaffer, or Schaefer, whatever he calls himself. Schaefer, I guess. This is, of course, Abel Danger, right? Abel Danger, Door Hop Galley. Got to remember those. My thesis was always that Abel Danger were the patsy minders, the people who were supervising the 9/11 patsies, right, this gaggle to the extent that they existed, and making sure that it was known what they were doing, right, and if necessary, come and get them out of trouble, right, if they got a speeding ticket, you had to come and fix that. That was Abel Danger. Anyway, Schaffer says, two shooters at least, back in a minute. Welcome back to the second hour of World Crisis Radio. Webster Toffley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. Let's just fill in a couple of more details here, or re-stress some of them. The two shooters, multiple shooters, right? The FBI and the local police are adamant, as is so often the case. Lone assassin, no conspiracy, a troubled, solid individual acting by himself is responsible, and therefore we focus more and more on the patsy and the soap opera of the life of the patsy. And we can actually, there are some things you can actually dig out of that. It's got to do with his father. But let's just remember now, I mentioned now, who says there's a second shooter? Eyewitness, victim, Daniel Gonzalez, reports the presence of a second person working together with the main shooter. And one of the things the second did was to prevent victims from leaving the nightclub, and he may also have been shooting. So, here's what the Gonzalez says. 50 people were trying to jump over each other, trying to exit the place. There was a guy holding the door and not letting us exit. He kept saying, stay inside, stay inside. And as he's saying that, the shooter keeps getting closer and closer, and the sound of bullets is getting closer. Everyone starts to panic. People are getting trampled. Let us out, let us out. Gonzalez first thought it was a hate crime because of the clientele of the Pulse nightclub. This guy is trying to prevent us from leaving, thinks Gonzalez. Maybe they're working together. I'm pretty sure it was more than one person. I heard two guns going at the same time. It was very, very crazy. Okay, so that's one. And the other one is Leidiana Puyanera. Again, once again, interviewed by Nick Valencia of CNN, and this must have been Tuesday night. She says, no way the gunman could have acted alone. And you can find the link to that at tarpley.net. And then, once again, as I say, this guy, Colonel Schaefer, this morning, this is on WMAL Radio, Washington, D.C., sometime about 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, say in that hour. And Colonel Anthony Schaefer is on there talking about a number of things, but he also says, looks more and more like two shooters, multiple shooters. Now, WMAL, this is the reactionary radio station here. This is where you hear Limbaugh, Savage, Mark Levin, essentially the reactionaries. WML goes so far as to blame Obama for the failures of the FBI. Now, this is quite fantastic, right? This appeals to a very stupid person. Only a very stupid person thinks that Obama controls the FBI. The FBI is out of control, has been for decades, right? Almost 100 years when you get down to it, right? Since J. Edgar Hoover took over in the 1920s. The FBI does what it wants. It does not take orders from presidents. Rather, it gives orders to presidents. It blackmails them, right? The typical visit with J. Edgar Hoover, here's the dirty stuff that's out there on you. Don't worry, we're keeping it under control, essentially, as long as you do what I tell you on the issues that are important to the FBI. That's what J. Edgar would say. And again, The distance between J. Edgar and Trump is not so much, right? Because this is the witch hunt, right? Senator Joe McCarthy, of course, important, but J. Edgar Hoover, whatever he says in that movie, is also quite close to it. All right, so we've gone through Robert Abel and the Lotus Gunworks of Jensen Beach. He's the one who said, "This was so strange, I called the FBI, but since I didn't have the guy's name, they didn't care." And they didn't care, because they didn't even send somebody to the store to ask, you know, for a description or other things to get the film from the camera there, which therefore was copied over and is now presumably lost. The other thing you want to watch out for is if they say, "Oh, the Patsy pledged allegiance to ISIS during a 911 call." I'm sorry, I don't believe that until you play the relevant tape. We said, "Oh, the Patsy pledged allegiance on Facebook." I'm sorry, that could have been anybody. That could have been somebody else who hacked in and got the code. That's not good enough. So ultimately, the means of tracing, somehow connecting the Patsy Mateen to ISIS are non-existent. In other words, there's no, I think some of the investigators have actually confessed, right, that there's no connection that can be shown. The other funny thing is that Mateen is not only born in the same state as Trump. He's not only born in the same city of New York as Trump. He's also born in the same borough of Queens. So in the borough of Queens, we have Trump born in Jamaica Estates. That's sort of on the western side of Queens, to some extent anyway. But Martin is born in the far eastern corner of Queens, and it's a township called New Hyde Park, which represents a number of things. It is a town in Nassau County. It's right across the city line, but it's also got a part of it which extends into the borough of Queens, and that's part of New York City. And that seems to be where the Patsy Mateen was born. Now, in terms of the soap opera, right, we have the stuff with the wives and so forth. Let me just mention a couple of things, though. The father is the main thing. So let's call him Mateen the Elder or Mateen Senior, okay? That's the father. Now, you can go to the internet and you can find this thing called Payame, P-A-Y-A-M-E, Afghan TV. Payame Afghan TV. And this is a broadcast that, according to published sources, is subsidized by the CIA. Now, if you look at the article that I wrote about this, it's the Thursday briefing. Here we see DurandJirga.com. Durand, the Durand line is the British line of demarcation between, at that time, between Afghanistan and British India. But of course, since the partition of British India, it's the line of demarcation, the border, if you will, between Afghanistan and Pakistan, right? That's the Durand line. And Jirga is the Afghan assembly, right? The assembly of notables, of local leaders. It's a kind of a court. It's a kind of legislature. It's all those things. So this guy, the father, is a mythomaniac, at least on the surface, an imposter, who sometimes pretends to be the president of Pakistan. He says, I'm your president, and I'm ordering you security guys and you army guys to go and arrest certain people, right? My opponents. You've got to go and arrest them. But the idea is the world of the Voice of America, there are such programs around here. They are targeted towards so-called captive nations. They're partially funded by the Voice of America. And the Voice of America is essentially a branch of the State Department. If you look at their board, the majority is from the State Department. Back in a minute. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. It's the afternoon of June 17th. 2016, just a reminder of the delirium of the fascist Trump. He gave a bunch of television interviews, I think, on Monday morning. Samantha Guthrie on NBC Today and also on Fox and Friends. And on one of these, Trump is quoted as saying, quote, we're led by a man, Obama, that either is not tough, not smart, or has something else in mind. And the something else in mind, people can't believe it. People cannot believe that President Obama is acting the way he acts and can't even mention the word radical Islamic terrorism. All right, so we have reviewed the two shooters, according to Lediana Puyanera. We have gone through the mass casualty drill. We've talked about G4S of Great Britain, right? British security. Well, that's the land of MI5 and MI6 and the rest of it. The father. There's a picture of the father up there with Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of Orange County, California, reactionary Republican, but with a difference, right? Somehow he is deployed to keep in touch with all sorts of countries where relations are strained. We've also got Colonel Schaffer of Able Danger, Dorhop Galley, along with Gonzalez and Puyanera, saying there had to be multiple shooters. The father comes from this world of the Voice of America. Voice of America has a broadcasting board that runs it these days. The chairman of the board is always the Secretary of State. And I think right now we got two State Department ambassadors on there and some other people who may well be from the State Department. So we remember, CIA is not the be-all and end-all of everything. It's often a convenient kind of shorthand. But State Department can be just as bad, and we'll get to that in just a minute. Ed Henson, the retired New York City detective, NYPD, New York cop, running the shooting center down there in, Sarasota? This character is the one who sold him the guns. And he went through, so basically I had, you know, he has all the technical details at his fingertips. And he says that's how he sold the gun to Mateen, we're told, by him. We really wonder what his influence is, right? There's a picture of Mateen wearing an NYPD t-shirt. And apparently that's his ego ideal, right? He wanted to be a cop. And I suppose New York cop is a good level of cop, if this is what you're interested in, Henson. And Henson had put up some Facebook postings which sounded very much like Trump, right? He had the F word all over the place, and he sent that against Islam, the Quran, and all sorts of other things. Very strange individual. We talked about Patsy Minders earlier, right? We were talking about many people thought that the Able Danger operation, with obviously the featured role of Colonel Schaefer, that would have been a Patsy Minding operation, and maybe Mateen had a Patsy Minder operation as well. So, the father, and so forth, right? So, Trump has shut his mouth off about Obama. That, by the way, is hurting him. It's not only good political advice, right? It's when terrorism happens on your opponent's watch, you want to keep a low profile. You want to let that just work for you. But, of course, Trump is incapable. Trump, I guess, is the opposite of Stalin, right? Stalin was famous for his ability to say nothing. With Trump, it's always the motor mouth, always the yap, always getting attention. Now, let's also talk a little bit about the question of magical thinking. I was very happy to see the other day that on, what was it, the day before yesterday, both Obama and Hillary talked about the absurdity of this thing with radical Islamic terrorism, or radical Islamist terrorism, might even be more accurate in their vocabulary. This is an example of magical thinking. As I have been saying for a good long time, that's magical thinking. In other words, it's a form of irrationalism. And what it essentially says is, if you only are able to formulate this incantation, then reality will change, right? So much of Trump's rhetoric turns out to be an appeal to magical thinking. Incantations, myths, spells, charms. We have, with the Daily Briefing, repeatedly exposed the magical quality of Republican verbiage. And you'll remember, the one who did this actually more than Trump was Cruz, right? Lying Ted was the one who kept saying, you've got to talk about radical Islamic terrorism. And then you think you've done something. And it was the idea is essentially, if you say the magic word, this phenomenon, whatever it is, will collapse. Well, it doesn't work. And I'm claiming credit for making this argument, right? Because it's part of my polemic against irrationalism, radical subjectivism, that somehow, if you say, like in that movie, right, the Knights of the Round Table movie, Excalibur, it's the charm of making, whatever that is, and the breath of the dragon, and if you can harness those, then you can change the world. That seems to be what Trump and the other Republicans are talking about, and it would be good to have more on cable TV, right? I'd be glad to come talking about magical thinking, irrationality, radical subjectivism as forms of decadence of human thought in the age of late imperialism. So this, I think, is that's a contribution of the Tax Wall Street Party to what is going on. But here's the other thing. You know, the magical thinking is when Trump says there's going to be a wall and Mexico is going to pay. This magical thinking, it's not going to occur. No politician could do that without ending his own political career. But let's talk a little bit about the magical thinking in some of Trump's other promises that are right now very relevant. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Now, magical thinking. It's one of the main features of Trump. I think you could argue the majority of the things he promises in his speeches are examples of magical thinking. They are incantations, myths, charms, and all irrational, right? All crazy action at a distance, crazy stuff. But look at what Trump has promised, right? Trump has said if terrorists come out of a village, then essentially that village will be destroyed. In other words, the relatives of the terrorists should be executed. Well, Trump, why don't you get out now, right, with your magical thinking? Here you've got Mateen, right? He's the official patsy. He's dead. That always makes it easier. By the way, that's quite a pattern that these patsies are getting eliminated. Well, it always has been, right? Back to Oswald. But remember, Trump said, we have to execute the families of terrorists. Well, what are you waiting for? Here's an example. We have the father of Mateen. We have the first wife of Mateen, the second wife of Mateen, and a child. And obviously, Trump, why aren't you calling for what you said? Trump has notably not called for the summary execution of these people. So Trump has already backed down from some of the most insane stuff. And you'll remember there's an interview with the New York Times editorial board on file where he says, everything I talk about is only a suggestion. It's only a proposal. I'm always flexible. I'm always realistic. But you called for the torture of people associated with terrorism or terrorists. Now, the same argument would apply. Trump, are you calling for the torture of people like the father, Mateen Sr.? Are you calling for the first wife? The second wife seems to be someone who knew quite a bit. Is Trump calling for the torture of that woman? How about the child? You can always torture anybody, right? If you're Trump, then that's understandable if you're Trump. So what I would note is that the savagery and the Hitlerian fury of what Trump has proposed, he seems already to have backed down, thank goodness, from some of it. But it shows the essential duplicity of Trump, right? That not only is he a fascist, but he's also a coward. And he makes these proclamations and he doesn't carry them out. So those are, I think, important points. The thing that occurs to me, of course, is does the wife of Mateen, the one that they say they might want to accuse of being an accessory, wait a minute, doesn't she have a lawyer? Has she been read her rights? Are there Miranda rights? Have those been put on the table for her? Because if she had a lawyer, the first thing that lawyer would tell her is, shut your mouth. Stop talking. And I just wonder. And has no lawyer come forward, right? Normally you get an ambitious young lawyer who wants to make a national reputation by, you know, saving a defendant in very, very rough straits. They would come forward. Has anybody come forward? Have they been sent away? Have they been intimidated by the FBI? Those are all interesting questions. Now, Marcy Kaptur, Congresswoman of Ohio, right, Toledo, she suggests that Trump is a ploy by Bill Clinton and by the Clintons in general. In other words, a phone call between Bill Clinton and Trump sometime in the early spring, maybe a year ago or more. And somehow the suggestion is, hey, Don, why don't you run for president? And with that, the megalomaniac seed was planted by the master manipulator. So it's possible. The only problem with that is watch out for the Frankenstein monster principle. In other words, you can create a Frankenstein's monster, and it can turn on you and destroy you. So that doesn't – in other words, that doesn't exhaust the topic. Somebody can be sent out as a Frankenstein's monster to kill somebody, but then it may come back and attack its creator. So we are told that Trump is still very weak logistically. He still has very little organization. He is such a tight-fisted miser we really don't believe he has all that money. We think that's a lot of baloney. His real estate empire, whatever it is not liquid, can't be turned into money without tremendous losses. We're told that Trump is too lazy to make fundraising phone calls. He's lazy. He's a megalomaniac, but he thinks that everything has to fall into place. The one thing that Trump has done this week is a further smashing up of the Republican machine. Now, you remember, in order to get dupes, rubes, suckers, gulls to vote for the Wall Street agenda, you had to mix in other issues, right? So one issue set was the evangelical Christian, allegedly, issue set. So that would get you perhaps the evangelical Christians as a fairly numerous voting bloc. Another one, of course, is this endless demagogy and harping on guns and all the rest. And that essentially meant that in the first case, you had the Elmer Gantries, you had the Billy Grahams, the chaplains of power, you had the Holy Rollers and the rest of them. You had to deal with them. But then in the second case, it's the National Rifle Association, right? A group of reactionaries who are essentially agents of the merchants of death, people who manufacture guns and want to continue to sell them. And, of course, given the ideological climate we live in, everything has to go to the most extreme forms. So the NRA has done that. But this week now, Trump, looking at very, very disappointing poll numbers for himself, has apparently decided that it's time to innovate once again. So what he's done now is to put a crack in this common front of pro-gun hysteria, extremism, and obsession. He now says, let's find ways. So if you're on the no-fly list or on the terrorist watch list, the no-fly list, I think, is, well, there's no official number, so we really don't know, but tens of thousands of people on each one. The no-fly list and the terrorist watch list, Trump now says we got to find a way to make sure that those people can't buy guns. The NRA, of course, hysterically opposed to any regulations, right? They would say, well, in the First Amendment, that's an absolute right, can't be regulated, so you do have the right to yell fire in a crowded theater, the NRA would say, because they say the Second Amendment, that's an absolute personal right, cannot be regulated, cannot be limited in any way, therefore you should be able to buy all sorts of heavy-duty military-grade weapons. So what we can hope for here is that they'll somehow, with Trump's abrasive personality, his bull in a china shop fascist style, that he'll wreck this part of the Republican machine. So what you see him doing, flailing around to try to get some kind of traction, is that he's busting up the entire Republican machine. So the wrecking ball. We were the first, right? Tex Wall Street Party wrecking ball poster. And Samson pulling down the temple on the heads of the Philistines. That's what we've got him doing. So go to it, Don. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Already our last segment of this program here, recorded on the 17th of June. Now, one of the ways that Trump is able to go on functioning in despite his really abysmal performance as a demagogue, right? He's a very faulty, he's a failing demagogue. He's not a successful demagogue. He's a third-class, fourth-class failure, miserable excuse for a successful effective demagogue, is ignorance about the actual plight of ISIS. Now, this morning, we have the wonderful news, which I really wanted to put first, but I thought we had to do this other stuff about stopping Trump. Fallujah is now in the process of being taken back by the Iraqi army. Remember, it's about 2 years ago that the Saudis and the Gulf states came in, bribed the Iraqi officers to flee. They fled. The men fled. ISIS came in. Fallujah is now in the process of being retaken, right? Probably another 10 days or so of mopping up, and Fallujah will have been liberated from the ISIS killers. This is absolutely fundamental. That opens then the way to Mosul, and we're also reminded this morning in a number of places that the Raqqa is the next stop, quite possibly, on the list. In other words, Raqqa, the capital of the infamous butchering ISIS, Islamic, Daesh, right? We don't even call them Islamic. They're not. Call them Daesh. Okay? So, people need to know about this. And then we've got Manjib. And Manjib is now surrounded. All the roads in, out are all cut. So, somebody has decided to do what we here have been calling for 1 year, 1 year ago, approximately. We began demanding, hey, we want the Jarablus corridor closed. That's the ISIS supply line from Turkey. Now, and that's now what's happening. All right. So we have the 51 warmongers of the State Department, the 51 warmongers. They have submitted a screed through the State Department dissent channel where these 50 undistinguished hacks, their names are not even worth citing, say that they want targeted strikes on Assad. Well, here's what I would do with those people. I would fire every one of them because my suspicion, prima facie, is that the 51 warmongers, whose names I don't know, who have put this screed in there through the dissent channel, and you don't have a document, right? That's classified, I guess. We're told that it's time for targeted strikes on Assad. I don't think that's what these people are concerned about. I think they're concerned about the fact that the noose is tightening around ISIS. These are people who want to defend the Islamic State. It reminds me that when Sri Lanka was about to wipe out the Tamil Tigers, we had, who was it at that point? French from Doctors Without Borders, the French foreign minister, and one of the two Labour Party brothers. He was the British foreign secretary. The French foreign minister, the British foreign secretary, ran to Ceylon to say, we have to have a humanitarian ceasefire. They were trying to save the Tamil Tigers as a terror pawn to be used against the government, right? That was Ed Miliband, right? So what I see here is the same thing. These people are in it enough to know that ISIS is being wiped out and they're trying to save ISIS. That's reprehensible, okay? And the Republicans are so stupid, they say, this proves that Obama has no anti-ISIS strategy. Actually, if you understand what's going on, it's the proof that Obama does at this point finally have an anti-ISIS strategy. Now, Obama went to the Treasury Department this week, special meeting of the National Security Council. So he talks about sending in some more forces, special forces of the U.S. to battle ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, Islamic State, Caliphate. We've now got two U.S. aircraft carriers in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Harry Truman and one more. B-52 bombers are hitting ISIL, Daesh with precision strikes. Targets and are being identified. 13,000 airstrikes so far, firing on all cylinders. Now, talks about killing ISIS leaders. ISIS is losing ground in Iraq. So Rutba, the Euphrates River Valley, the town of Hit, Haditha, all of these have been reasserted, recaptured, or liberated. Fallujah is now surrounded. The Tigris River Valley, Makmur, Mosul will be on the agenda. So by now, ISIS, Daesh have lost half of the populated territory they once had in Iraq. Now, Syria, assisted by our special operations forces, a coalition of local forces is now pressuring the key town of Manbij, which means the noose is tightening around ISIS, Daesh, in Raqqa as well. Our coalition continues to be on offense. ISIL is on defense. It's been a full year since ISIS has been able to mount any successful offensive operation in Syria or Iraq. And there's also the question, the reason they're at the Treasury is because Secretary Liu, L-E-W, of the Treasury is doing everything to cut the ISIS terror off from the international money system. Now, you notice the U.S. media tell you this stuff, right? I am not sure. You should do a census on ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, Fox, the rest of them. Have you talked about Manbij? Have you talked about the Gerardus Corridor? A lot of them want to hide the fact that the main supply line comes from Turkey. So that is, I think, that's the area where a lot of people of goodwill could do a lot, right? Make sure that people know that ISIS is in decline now. They're in retreat. The tide has turned, and they're getting slammed. So again, Obama, keep doing this. Keep wiping out ISIS militarily, but you're going to have to put the mole detectors at FBI, CIA. Now, I'd hope to talk about the Brexit. Let me just say about Brexit. Things like this do not offer any solutions. In other words, the idea of breaking up existing nations or existing combinations of states and hope to get any benefit out of it is simply a chimera. It's a pipe dream. So I don't think there's any merit in the call for the British to leave the European Union. And I'm sure I'm going to have people screaming that this is, that it's time for Britain to reassert itself. I would say there are probably two factions in the British ruling class, and they control this stuff, believe me. One faction says, stay where you are, keep parasitizing the production of Germany, France, Italy, and the rest of the continental European Union and Ireland and others. Like, just keep the status quo and you're doing okay, right? Keep visiting derivatives on them. The other group is the more extreme group, the more adventurous group. I look at the pro-Brexit group as essentially ruling class forces who are looking for singing tomorrows through the Chinese-British alliance, the Sino-British alliance that emerged last mid-October with President Xi of China. It is a comprehensive alliance. So the idea then is the adventurous group says, break out of the European Union, work with China, try to make Britain the key to the balance of power, and undertake a course of adventurism and brinksmanship. And that would be in line with the infamous Venetian Republic, about which I've written a thing or two. So I think you're probably going to be a better world if this thing fails, if the exit fails, because if you let the exit succeed, you're going to be giving power to a more dangerous group, sort of like backers of Trump here in the United States. So sorry, no to Brexit. We'll see you again next week on World Crisis Radio.